Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. I'd like to begin today's program with a couple of quotes you might enjoy. Here's the first. Why should we think upon things that are lovely? Because thinking determines life. It is a common habit to blame life upon the environment. Environment modifies life, but does not govern life. The soul is stronger than its surroundings. This by William James, American psychologist, 20th century. And another quote, an eye is meant to see things. The soul is here for its own joy. And this by Rumi, Sufi mystic and poet, 13th century. What do these great quotes and traditions have in common? We'll find out in this hour. Today on the Godspeed Institute, we welcome Robert Frager, Ph.D., founder of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California, where he is currently professor of psychology and director of the Spiritual Guidance Master's Program. Dr. Frager is a Sufi teacher in the Helveti Jirahi Sufi Order, an international order based in Istanbul, Turkey. He is president of the Jirahi Order of California and has been a Sufi spiritual guide for over 25 years. He has also received a 7th degree black belt in Aikido and has been an instructor for over 45 years. His latest book is Sufi Talks, Teachings of an American Sufi Sheikh, which we will develop more into today. Dr. Frager, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, and happy Mother's Day to everybody.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, yes, and also with those in your family.
Thank you. Now,
is it all right if I call you Robert?
Oh, of course. Bob is fine, too.
Bob. Okay, that was my dad's name. In your journey, let's start with one beginning place here, because, of course, Sufism and all spirituality is ultimately a journey of the heart. What touched your heart in a way that that guided your life?
Well, in a sense, the whole journey began with my heart being touched. I was founding president of the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology for about 8 or 9 years, and we invited spiritual teachers from all over the world, from all different traditions. We also invited scholars, psychologists, from all different persuasions, and one day in 1980, the school had been around for 5 years, we invited a Sufi master and his dervishes. He came with an entourage. We invited them in. They did a tour of the United States. They were from Istanbul. Mm. And one of my faculty had met him some years before in Istanbul, and they approached him to ask if the school was capable and willing to host them, and we agreed. And I was sitting in my office on the telephone, kind of doing my job as president, which involved a lot of meetings, a lot of phone calls. Mm. And this man, who I'd never seen before, walked by my door, and the door was like three quarters closed. It was sort of, well, I'm busy, but I could see people if it's important. Mm. And he didn't stop. He didn't break stride. He glanced into the room and kept walking. And the moment he glanced at me, time stopped. I had this sense of connection. I had a sense that instantly all the details of my life were available to him, almost as though my life was a stream of data squirted through an incredibly high-speed connection into a great computer. Mm. And at the same time, I had the sense that he knew how it was and how it was all going to come out. That was my first connection with my first Sufi master. I had no expectation. I didn't know who he was at the time. And it was a connection that was really a heart connection more than anything else. As I got to know him, I fell in love with him, and it was a very deep and not an intellectual sort of love. I mean, it was a sensual as well as heartfelt as well as intellectual love. It was sort of a full person love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I loved to look at him. I loved who to listen to him. I loved the sense of his presence. And that love, in a sense, was the foundation for my becoming a dervish. And whatever development I think I've made in this path has come from the love I've had of my teachers and of my tradition.
Mm. What a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing.
Oh, you're welcome.
That extensively. It sounded like when you talk, I got the image of a gate, like just some gateway through which, you know, you could go and he could go.
Sure.
And it was trust. I mean, just
fabulous.
Yeah,
in some ways, it was a gateway through which I was pushed. By God.
Yes, yes. Now, did you have a tradition before this? Or some frame of reference?
Yeah, I've my karma, as it were, has been to be in most of the world's religious and spiritual traditions. I was born Jewish, born and raised in New York City.
Hey.
Yeah. And
<Me too.
laughs> as I grew up, I was committed in some ways to exploring Judaism as a powerful, inspiring faith. And yeah, as I got older, I looked for more. I wanted to try meditation, and I ended up in Japan in 1964 and began a meditation practice along with my Aikido practice, both of which I did daily for many years. In fact, I'm still doing the Aikido practice, just my meditative practice has changed. And that brought me basically to the Hindu tradition. I became a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, who's a very well-known teacher in the West. And I did that tradition, meditating in the morning and evening, long meditations every week. It was a very serious tradition for me. At the same time, I came back to the States and began teaching psychology of religion, and invited, again, different teachers from different traditions. I became close to a wonderful Zen master, and I sat Zazen with my teacher. I had another Indian teacher who was like an older sister, sort of on the path rather than a guru. So I've had this sense that, I've been put into different paths and have explored in some depth these other traditions. And then finally, I met my Sufi teacher and, really had the feeling that I was set on this path. It was larger than my personal choice.
Mm. Mm, it sounds like home.
It's
interesting. We're on our third year of the program, and we've explored many traditions and paths, you know, around the world. And we know, for example, in the Jewish tradition, there is the mystical tradition of it as well, in the Kabbalah, and in other, like in, for example, my own background, going back into Catholicism, there's a whole mystical tradition there as well. But we have, you know, found people explore other traditions that actually offer tools, like practices, to help inform this journey. And we also find that on the mystical level, there's great almost unity, because in mysticism, there seems to be a common language and a timelessness and an eternity and similar images across religious traditions around the world. And it's just a joy to listen to your journey as you explore things that help to, you know, all your interests seem to inform each other.
Yeah, I think they have in a strange way, although years ago I did an interesting interview for a magazine called What is Enlightenment? It's still on the Internet. It was called The Man with Two Heads.
Yeah.
And the two heads were my psychological head and my Sufi head. And sometimes they contrast a little more. You know, sometimes I can sit with my hat as a Sufi teacher on and say, psychology, who needs it? It's a waste of time. It's a silly intellectual setting up exercise. And absolutely mean it. And yet other times I'm not quite as schizophrenic, and I'm a little more integrated with the different parts of myself.
Sure, sure. Now, in your book, which I believe is it going to be published in July?
I believe so.
Yes,
July 10th.
It's coming right around the corner. And it's called Sufi Talks, Teachings of an American Sufi Sheikh. And it's a collection of conversations about spiritual topics drawn from your weekly teachings. Now, is that a tradition in the Sufi, you know, relationship between teacher and the dervish?
Very much so. It takes different forms. It depends, for one thing, how large a congregation or how large a group of dervishes a teacher has. It ranges from, you know, long conversations in a coffee house, which, of course, is like an old Oriental tradition that is still alive and well in Istanbul today. But it also includes sort of semi-formal talks and interchange between the sheikh and the dervishes. It's a way of reminding people of what they already know, and it's a way of sometimes introducing new ideas that they may not have thought about. And it's a way of me learning a hell of a lot and preparing for it.
Mm. And you have gathered or distilled basically a collection of these across a broad array of topics in your new book.
Yes, yeah. It's not distilled, I'm afraid. It's edited, you know, certainly edited down. I'm not sure of what the process was of choosing which talks. It was a very organic process. And there was, because there were so many talks, I've given a talk a week for almost 25 years.
Mm.
I've recorded them for the last maybe 10. We chose out of you know, probably a 5-year span or so of those talks, the ones that I thought had some relevance. And frankly, as I was working on it, I lost all perspective, and I, you know, was left thinking, is this going to be of value to anybody else?
Really?
You know, I think it is, and people who have read it said it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, one gets so close to the material, you sort of don't know.
Yes, yes, there's a certain amount of letting go involved. In the process. Now, a Sufi order, and you've described this in your book materials, is described as a chain in which each sheikh is connected to their own teacher, and that this chain reaches unbroken to the founder of the order, to great Sufi saints of the past, all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad and to God. Could you please share more about this chain? It brings to mind to me what in the Roman Catholic Church has been called apostolic succession.
Uh-huh.
Why is this unbroken chain important?
Well, I think it's for exactly the same reason that apostolic succession is important in the Church. I mean, I've never practiced Catholicism, although I did teach with Matthew Fox, the great Christian theologian, for quite a number of years, so I know something about the tradition and dearly love many of the great Catholic saints, especially Meister Eckhart.
Mm-hmm.
I think something passes through that chain, and the fact that ideally each link connects to the link before means it's something larger than personal. I think in the West we're so dedicated to a kind of hyper-individualism, and we begin to think of the spiritual path as one person's journey. It's never one person's journey. You know, it's always done. There are teachers involved. There's communities involved. I mean, unless you suddenly get inspired and then go off to a cave all by yourself, and I don't think that's ever been successful, because I think one needs a teacher, and I think one needs a community for at least part of the journey.
Right.
The metaphor I've come up with is a little modern take on the notion of the chain, which is that we're like a pipeline. And something flows through that pipeline. And what flows through it is not from me. I'm simply the last section of pipe, as it were. And there's an energy, there's a blessing, there's a wonderful word in Arabic and Hebrew, baraka, which is both means prayer and blessing and energy. And that flows through the pipeline. The important thing is that each section of pipe is well connected to the section before and the section after, and that we don't leak.
Mm.
You know, and by leaking, I mean it's important that those of us who are teachers walk our talk. You know, that we do our very best to live honest and moral lives. Because not to means that energy won't pass through us, or certainly a lot of it will get lost because we can't hold it if our lives aren't in accord with our teachings. So for me, that makes a lot of sense as a metaphor, that something does flow through me, and it's really not from me, and it's not mine, and I trust it a lot more because it isn't.
Right. Exactly.
That, in fact, I teach by inspiration as much as anything else, that I'll often prepare a talk. It is an interesting dynamic about these talks. I'll prepare a talk and work for hours on reading and thinking, and then I'll get into our Sufi center, and I'll start, and all of a sudden the talk veers off in a direction I didn't expect.
Right.
And I'm watching myself talking about something, often quite eloquently with a lot of passion, but I hadn't planned on saying it. And then afterwards, more often than not, some of the dervishes will come up and they'll say, "Oh, thank you so much. That addressed what I was really needing to hear. That was so important." Mm. And I really have a feeling that, I was inspired or drawn or something happened, that there's an alchemical sort of connection, that results in these talks as live, sort of inspired teachings.
Yes. Yes, I can hear that. Now, you use the word saints in your writings, and that's a subject near and dear to my own heart. Can you share, what is a saint in the Sufi tradition?
Well, the concept of saint is really an Islamic concept more than a Sufi concept. And I think it's one who loves God, one who has attained a certain level of spiritual awareness and spiritual connection with the divine. In Sufism, we certainly have some very well-developed models of what are stages of spiritual progress. But I've never heard someone say, you apply the term saint at this level.
Right.
So, I often hear the term saint. It's often it's often given to the founder of an order or to, there are stories of very great Sufi saints who often had worked miracles or, clearly exhibited something beyond normal ways of being and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they were at levels of spiritual development that allowed them to behave in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard saint clearly defined. I've just heard it used, and I've sort of learned by osmosis what it means, I suppose.
Oh, yes, yes, thank you. Now, in terms of loving service that you mentioned, let's talk a bit about the heart now. The opening of the heart is central to your own work and in your upcoming book as well. And if I can, I'd like to read a quote from one of your articles that I located. That says,
how could I say no?
How can I refuse? Yes,
no.
It says, the heart is a temple that has been placed by God in everyone, a temple that houses the divine spark within us. In a saying much beloved by the Sufis, God reveals, "I, who cannot fit into all the heavens and earth, fit in the heart of the sincere believer." Can you share a little more about this opening of the heart and how it is central in our not only our spiritual development as individuals, but as far as moving us forward together?
Uh-huh. Well, my teachers have said that in many ways modern Sufism really is like the two wings of a bird, that there are two things that we must work on. One is the opening of the heart, the development of the capacity for love and compassion, and the other is self-analysis, sort of work on one's ego and one's unconsciousness, and that they balance each other. So I just wanted to put the idea of the opening of the heart in context, that it's sort of half the work.
Mm.
And paradoxically, that throws me right back on the other half, which is, why is the heart closed? I think our hearts are closed because of our own self-preoccupation. We need to learn to be truly compassionate. We need to learn to love. we need to develop those capacities within ourselves. And there are two ways to do it. One is to realize what that pattern of narcissism and self-centeredness is within us, because the more we can see it, the better we can work on it. But the other is the more positive work of acting with compassion, really performing loving service. The work in Sufism often consists of chanting, and in much of the chanting we turn our heads from right to left, and as we go to the left we go slightly down, in a sense pointing the chin or nodding into the heart. Mm-hmm. And we would recite Allah, for example, or other phrases in Arabic, with a sense of bringing God into the heart at one level. Or another way I've thought recently of it is acknowledging that God is in the heart. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we have to put God in there, but in a sense our job is to realize that God is there.
Mm-hmm. And already so abides there. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the opening of the heart at one level is to remove the veils of unconsciousness or the veils in which, you know, those really powerful veils are the veils that say, well, God is far from me.
Right.
And that's a terrible self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
So, you know, in our actual work in what we call zikr or remembrance, much of which is chanting or reciting the names of God, a good part of it is with physical movement and ending with, in a sense, energizing the heart, or, you know, making a divine connection, you know, with our hearts. I think, well, my old sheikh once put it this way. This was Muzaffar Effendi, the gentleman who glanced at me and changed my
changed
life.
Changed your life, yes.
in a timeless moment. And he said, you know, every kind word opens the heart. Every kind glance, every compassionate act softens and opens the human heart. And at the same time causes a rose or another flower, he said rose, to bloom somewhere on earth.
Yeah.
In other words, that we what we do doesn't just affect us. And then he said, and you know, every unkind, thoughtless word, unkind act, etc., closes the heart slightly and causes a thorn to grow on a rose bush. And then he said, you know how many more thorns there are on a rose bush than there are roses?
Yeah.
It's a sign that we have a lot of work to do. So, that sort of says it all in some ways.
Now, as you share about this, I get a very real, physical, palpable sense about this relationship with the heart and about energy being sort of guided toward and into the heart through the chanting. I also found in one of your writings about a practice that, and I'll quote again, the more aware you are of your heart center, the more the heart becomes open and energized. As you are going about your daily business, think of your heart as a miniature sun that radiates light to everyone and everything you meet. And again, there's that palpable energy I sense in what you're sharing about, you know, sort of almost charging up your heart and then, you know, allowing it to shine out.
Yeah, yeah. And in this, interestingly, as opposed to other forms of working with energy, the more you send that energy out, the more the heart radiates. It doesn't lessen as you do it. You know, and that's, I think, a very powerful visual practice. What I've been also teaching is we should get in the habit of blessing everyone we meet as we walk along the street, to say, God bless you, or its equivalent. And again, that does the same thing. It's expressing compassion to beings around us. I think sometimes we say it when we see someone who's in a wheelchair, or someone who, you know, clearly is physically suffering, or someone who's homeless and clearly not in charge of their own lives, and we feel compassion to them, and we may, you know, say a quick prayer or think kind thoughts. But how about people that are not obviously suffering, which is all, which is everyone in a sense.
Right, or folks we actually struggle with, perhaps, in you know, relationships in the workplace, things that happen all the
time,
for many people.
Yeah, and so it's easy to say, but it's a very challenging practice to do, is to bless bless others, to
right.
think, wish for the best for them. And as I said, this is a powerful visualization. The visualization, by the way, I got from an American teacher who was not a Sufi. There's a wonderful book by Laura Huxley, who was Aldous Huxley's wife and who I had the pleasure of meeting on a number of occasions. And she was a wonderful sort of gifted energy healer. She had a real feeling for working with energy with people, and she had, the way she put it, she called it the sunflower exercise. And she said, imagine you have a sunflower in your heart, you know, and it's a deliberate pun. Your sunflower sends light to the sunflower in the heart of the person next to you. And I also learned, you know, basically the same practice from another one of my teachers, my yoga teacher, Swami Radha, who I watched counsel people, and I watched her send that sort of love and all-accepting compassion to people as she counseled them, as she gave them spiritual advice and worked with them, and it was an extraordinarily powerful thing to watch. So I tried to do it and to teach it. I wish I was better at it.
You know what I love about sunflowers is they don't just follow the sun with their face. Their entire being turns.
Yes.
You know, their
wow.
leaves, everything turns
yeah.
to follow the sun. And, you know, it's, to me, a pretty potent spiritual example.
Absolutely.
Now, is this what you mean about the heart when you say it's seen as a mediator between the outer influence of the world and the spiritual influences within us? Is this how does the heart mediate for us in the, especially in the Sufi tradition?
Sure. Well, that is really taken from a somewhat complex model of the heart. I hate to plug, but I did write another book that Quest also has published some years ago called Heart, Self, and Soul. And I talk in that book about a model of the heart that comes from a great 8th century Sufi sage. And it's sort of amazing to have something that old. You know, we're talking about something that's 12 centuries old. And yet it's a very powerful model that could have been written yesterday. And this great sage said there are four levels to the heart. And the deeper you go within, the closer you get to the divine spark in us. The soul in us. And basically what I was talking about is the outermost heart, or what he called the breast, the part of us that houses the heart, if you will.
Right.
And that's the part, I mean, if you think about it, we lead with our breast as we walk in the world.
Right.
You know, we encounter the world in some ways physically with the front of our torso.
Right.
And that's in a way a metaphor for with this part of the heart, we encounter the world, we learn from the world, we interact with the world. In a way, it's the home of our embodied intelligence, but the lesser intelligence, the more worldly intelligence that consists of things we learn from the world and in our experience with the world. It houses the heart proper, which is goes the other way. It's the source of the inner knowledge that comes from the soul. And so you have these two, the first two levels of the heart. One learns from and interacts with the outside. The second level learns from and interacts with the inside, with the soul deeper within. And, you know, it gets rather complicated,
right.
But that's the short answer to your question.
And in depth, it... the things get a little harder. I have an artichoke metaphor that I use.
As
you get closer to the heart.
Yeah, well, at least it's not an onion metaphor. I'm not a Buddhist.
I
believe there is
that,
a soul within. Oh, I've been a Buddhist. Yes, the so it goes from the outermost heart, the breast, to the innermost heart, the heart proper.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the heart proper, then to the innermost heart, which, again, this great sage said, this is the place of vision. I mean, the heart itself knows from in an inner way, but there's a deeper knowing that comes from actually sort of inner vision, really comprehending in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the very core, the heart of hearts. I love Arabic can get very poetic.
Yeah.
So in your heart of hearts is basically the soul itself. And when I was writing my this book on Sufi psychology, I got sort of impatient with this great 8th century sage named Al-Tirmidhi, because he just broke into poetry when he started talking about the innermost heart.
Mm.
And it's like I started dialoguing with him in my head, and I said, look, I have a book to write, and it's supposed to be a book about Sufi psychology, and you're not doing anything useful for me here. You're just writing, you know, that God waters with his own hands the fruit of the tree of deepest inner wisdom, and I'm going, how can I put that? And then I suddenly realized that's exactly what I'm going to put, because how can you talk in any linear way?
Right.
About that level of consciousness, that he's absolutely right, that you have to go to poetry or some other way of beginning to express the truth of that which is beyond words.
Mm, thank you so much for that answer, Robert. And we are going to get more into your book after the break.
You.
We're about
okay.
halfway through the program right now, and you are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we will continue this fabulous conversation with Robert Frager, founder of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and author of Sufi Talks, Teachings of an American Sufi Sheikh. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Aretha Franklin on Mother's Day at the Godspeed Institute. Turn it up and stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Robert Frager, founder of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and the author of Sufi Talks, Teachings of an American Sufi Sheikh. Now, Robert, in this part of the program, I'd like to focus more on your new book. I know it'll be published this summer by Quest, but can we explore some of its principles here?
Of course.
Please. There's so much. I was able to do a little research into it. There's a talk about character and components that help lead to character. Can we explore a little bit of that in this part of the program? And, you know, when I think of character, of course, it's individual in our culture. especially. But I'm also beginning to think of it as a more corporate issue of much larger bodies of people, nations, etc. So let's discuss character a little.
Okay, the notion of character in the Sufi tradition is really based on the idea that we are original. We're born with an original nature as human beings, and our original nature is pure and, in a way, perfect. Babies are not born with bad habits, for example.
Right.
That most of what you can think of that we want to change in ourselves, or that we'd like others to change in themselves, consist of learned behavior one way or the other. We're born with very little. In fact, you know, what we're really born with is sort of a knee-jerk reflex and a startle reflex, not much.
Yeah.
We learn everything else. So in contrast, I think, to the concept of original sin, and I certainly working with Matthew Fox, he went on and on about how if you start with original sin, you can't get very far, because as a sinful, imperfect person, there's not a lot of... It's hard to get out of that sort of pit that one puts oneself in. But in Islam, one is born as a perfect human being, as it were, or certainly with an innate, healthy nature. But unfortunately, what happens is we do develop habits, and we often... that nature gets covered over by habits, by society. As you said, there's a larger corporate sense to what goes on. It's not never all individual growth and development.
Right.
And a part of our job is to refine our original nature. Interestingly enough, the word zikr means remembrance. It's remembrance of God. Well, remembrance means to come back to what you already knew.
Mm.
You know, we want to remember what we knew perhaps before we were born. And similarly, we want to regain the character or the sort of inner clarity and purity that we were born with.
And zikr, or the remembrance of God, as you mentioned before, this is through chanting?
Mostly through chanting. I mean, anything that gets us to remember God technically is zikr,
okay.
Is remembrance. And it's spoken of, for example, in Islam, that traditional Muslim prayers are one of the best forms of zikr. But that's, of course, if you keep your mind on God when you pray, which is a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
In our form of zikr, we use rhythmical sort of breath and movement and chanting. We also use classic Turkish Sufi music as sort of a background to the chanting, almost in counterpoint to it. And it's a, you know, it's an ancient ritual that we do every week. It lasts anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half generally.
Mm.
And it's a group ritual. You can do other forms of zikr by yourself. I mean, we work with prayer beads, for example, and that's a private sort of individual practice of remembering God by chanting different names of God or different attributes of God. But what we generally talk about when we talk about zikr is the communal practice, and which requires musicians and, you know, people that know the movements to guide newcomers in how to perform the ritual.
Mm. And then there's another component, I believe, called halvet, or spiritual retreat.
Yeah.
Is this another aid in helping us to restore?
Yes.
Our nature?
The traditional retreat was 40 days, which
40 days.
We don't do today for all kinds of reasons, one of which is very
mortgage
few people
payment.
Have the time.
Yeah.
And I personally recommend that people take short retreats, if even for a few hours one evening a week.
Mm.
I mean, it's not hard. Turn off the computer, turn off the phone, turn off the television, and even just spend a few hours reading scripture, meditating, contemplating the work of a great saint. But it's hard for us to turn those things off. We somehow think we have to be connected to the world every moment. And it's interesting. We're connected to the world, which, of course, then we're not connected with the divine, either within or without.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's interesting as, you know, as someone who's spent quite a bit of time leading retreats and attending retreats, it's amazing the frequency. It's almost a change of frequency that one gets on.
Yes.
In that solitude, even with other people, it's still a kind of enclosure of solitude. And
absolutely. And you hate to go back.
Well, you know, in the moment folks can get in their cars and then they head out and the phone comes out and it's like they changed frequencies.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's that, to me, that's always that's the thing to practice is, you know, then how do we continue that as best as possible? And you're suggesting something very helpful, which is just to make it a point of making it part of our daily or weekly life, you know,
right.
which we can do.
Well,
turn off that TV.
Sure. And even to try to make our moments, shorter moments of meditation or prayer, moments that feel like a retreat. If we can really step into that place that's, you know, in which we're not standing firmly in the world, but we're standing in a sort of liminal threshold place between heaven and earth, if you will, then prayer does become like a retreat. And it's a powerful practice and difficult, very challenging to do.
And now then, adab, or right action, this seems to be a third component in developing or rather restoring the character.
Yeah, well, I would translate adab. It's one of those wonderful words that, you know, everybody says, well, you can't translate it. This simply means it's difficult and you need a sentence instead of a word. Right action feels a little too Buddhist to me, frankly.
Okay.
But it's more, it's almost more like etiquette. It's but deeper than etiquette, you know, in an Emily Post sense.
Right.
It's the sort of etiquette that a really wonderful hostess or host welcomes someone to their home. Mm. You know, if you do it well, I mean, you put people at their ease. You're really giving a great gift by treating people with sort of grace, the kind of service, and it's how you do service. But what's really important, of course, is it reflects inner respect, inner compassion, inner love for the other person. It's not just the outer form. So there are some outer forms in Sufism. You know, one puts one's hand over one's heart and bows slightly when meeting other dervishes or when entering the Sufi center or when greeting the sheikh. But the outer form is basically supposed to be a reminder that, you know, one is dropping into one's heart, that one is respecting and wishing to serve others. So it's how, you know, in a way, I always... my favorite Sufi is Mother Teresa in many ways. And, you know, she said so beautifully, it's not what you do, it's how much love you do it with.
That's right.
And I think that's the essence of adab. Good adab is when you do it with love and compassion and a sort of, for example, if we serve a lot of tea because we're still Middle Eastern in our roots. and when the person coming to serve tea does it with a sense of gratitude that they have the opportunity to serve, that's good adab. Mm. When the person receives the tea, doesn't think, well, I could get a bigger cup, or why didn't he serve me first, or, you know, why isn't the tea hotter, that's not particularly good adab. But when you say, oh, with an inner sense of gratitude, which is, do I deserve this tea? This is a gift. This is a free gift. Someone has come to me, taken the trouble to prepare the tea, bring it to me, and so I'm grateful. And so when the person who's grateful for serving meets the person who's grateful for being served, something happens. It's a very different encounter than the usual encounter we have, and there's a divine element in it.
That's
one
powerful.
Can see it.
Yeah. Engaging each other as a beloved guest or visitor.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think, imagine the person coming to you to serve you tea has just walked for a day through a hot desert to bring it to you. Can you feel that sort of gratitude? And of course, you know, we're so used to taking it for granted, taking each other for granted.
Oh yes, and far worse.
Yeah.
Right. You know, now so we get to then obstacles on the path. As you share about in your new book. What are some of the obstacles on our path?
Well, one of the big ones in Sufi psychology is the ego. And by ego, I think you really need to define it more precisely, because ego can mean many things. It really is what I've called the self-centered ego, the selfish ego, or the narcissistic ego, which I think is the undeveloped part of the ego. I think kids are narcissists. They just mostly focus on their needs and their wants and find it very difficult to even imagine what anyone else wants when they're young.
Right.
And that's normal. What's not normal is when we get to be 30 and 40 and still can't focus on what anybody else needs but ourselves.
That's interesting,
You know, Ken Wilber, who's a very well-known sort of spiritually oriented psychologist, said, you know, we could summarize healthy human development as successive loss in narcissism.
Right.
And so we begin with a fairly sophisticated psychology that says, look, we start off by being focused on ourselves and our needs. We start off by thinking of ourselves as separate beings, and therefore what we need is really important. And yet, along with thinking of ourselves as separate, we think of ourselves as separate from God, which creates a whole host of problems, which technically is really a sin in Islam, because when you say that you're separate and independent of God, you're almost setting yourself up, you know, as semi-divine yourself, because we believe nothing exists outside of God. So this thing in us is like a little Satan in us almost.
Yeah.
That's trying to convince us to act only for our own benefit, to take advantage of others, and even to ignore our own creator. You know, the ego sort of whispers, oh, pay attention to me, I'm right here and I'm more important. So it's a big struggle. I mean, it's really it's where the term inner jihad comes from. Jihad in Arabic really doesn't mean to, you know, commit holy war, especially not terrorism against innocent civilians.
Right.
That's never, ever been condoned by any sane Muslim. But there's a wonderful story in which Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, was coming back from the first great battle after the Muslims had moved to Medina, and they were outnumbered more than 3-1, and they won, partly because of his generalship and because of God's blessings. And as they're coming back all bandaged and, you know, beaten but victorious, I mean, they're all beaten up, and he said, turns around and says to the soldiers around him, well, now we're going to the greater jihad. Everybody gasps and goes, oh, what do you mean the greater jihad? You know, our arrows are gone, our swords are broken. You know, what great warfare or what great struggle are we going to? And he pointed to his chest. He said, the struggle with that which is within your breast. And jihad really does mean struggle more than warfare, by the way.
Yes, yes.
So, yes. You know, and I think every spiritual path has of necessity its own version of it. Although I know when I was practicing yoga, some of the Bhakti traditions say, well, just keep loving, and the more you love, the more everything falls away. And I find that may be true for some people, but for most of us, it's not true. I can, I could become more loving in many ways and more devotional, but my ego would just subvert that.
Right.
As soon as I blinked my eye, it would do something very self-centered.
Right. And there's
so
a lot
that's
of
why.
So there's inner work
that needs
to be done, and prayer is part of that. And something you've written about as well is the practices of surrendering to God. And I bring it up only because the whole concept of surrender tends to be misunderstood in Western spirituality. It can be as well as something that's just unpleasant altogether.
Yes.
A similar thing of the word obedient or obedience. The etymology of the word actually means to listen, to really listen to someone.
Right.
It's not a subservient idea. Could you speak a little bit to this idea of surrendering to God that can be a very different experience or understanding, one of great beauty, for example?
Well, sure.
And some of the fruits of that.
Well, I think it, in a sense, one way of looking at it is if one can become still and one can make that connection with the deeper parts of ourselves and act from that rather than from our just our intellect or just our ego alone, in a sense, that is surrender of the part of us that we usually operate out of to a part of us that's deeper. So surrender to God does not necessarily mean, you know, like the surrender of a soldier to another soldier or, you know, here, I'm going to surrender to this big human-like figure in front of me.
Right.
But it, in some ways, it means to surrender, to give up our allegiance to that ego in us, which is a terrible tyrant, to acknowledge that it runs our life all too often, and then can we find something else to guide us rather than be guided by this narcissistic, self-centered, selfish, immature part of ourselves? Because the truth is all too often we've surrendered to it.
Yeah.
So it really is to surrender to that which is deepest in us. And I don't like surrender either. I think it's to learn to follow, learn to be guided by that which is deepest in us. To be guided by a sense of truth, to be guided by love, by beauty, as opposed to the way we're often guided, which is guided simply by our selfish interest.
Mm. Now, one more thing from the book, Waking Before We Die. Could you share a little bit of what that conversation might be about?
Sure, although I must confess I'm going to talk out of more book learning than experience.
Okay. Good. Well, you know.
Not everybody gets there. It's even called to die before dying in the Sufi tradition, which is, you know, could we be so unattached to the world? Could we be unattached to the world in the way that we would be if we knew we only had 5 minutes left to live or a day left to live? I mean, at that moment, what falls away? Almost everything. You know, and then we can reflect on what's truly important.
Hmm.
And so we live in a world, I mean, which is almost psychotic in the way that we have our priorities so crooked. I mean, we pay allegiance to all this transient stuff of the world and then fail to pay attention to that which nourishes our souls. We fail to pay attention to that which truly is truly important to us, which we would understand if we thought we only had a day left. You know, immediately we would get it. We don't need a spiritual teacher or secret teachings or anything else. We would simply, you know, realize that almost everything that we've been focused on is not as important as we thought it was. Our perspective would change.
Right, it all falls away.
Yeah, and the trick is, could we change our perspective without the doctor saying you've got cancer or heart? You know, your heart is going.
Right.
And it's that simple and that difficult.
Mm. Now, thank you very much
for
that. That's very poignant, you know, place of deep meaning there. I can't let you go today without touching base on Aikido. Here you are.
One of my favorite bases.
Seventh degree black belt. And it's utilized in the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. It's part of the education, and you know, a Sufi master. It's fascinating that you combine the mystical wisdom of Islam with the martial arts mastery of Aikido as well. Could you please share some of that experience or explain the common ground of Aikido and Sufism, and how do they inform each other in practice?
Well, I was very lucky, very blessed to have met and become the personal student of the founder of Aikido. I went to Japan in 1964, and I trained at the main dojo in Tokyo for a total of 2.5 years after that. And he was a mystic. I mean, what drew me to Aikido, there was this amazing aha experience when I saw his picture in an early English language book on Aikido.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, the martial arts are love. And I had done other martial arts before. I'd done judo and karate and other things. And my teachers often talked about philosophy, but my experience was I was learning to throw people down, to kick and punch and right. to win contests. And somehow, I can't tell you how, I knew that the founder of Aikido absolutely meant it, that the martial arts are love and that Aikido embodied that principle. It wasn't just lip service. I don't know how I knew. And I knew I had to study Aikido. It turns out I was in Hawaii studying Japanese full-time at the University of Hawaii, and lo and behold, I found out that the main dojo in Hawaii was 15 minutes from where I was living, from campus. So I started just for a few months studying Aikido in Hawaii, and when I went to Japan, my first day in Japan, I immediately went to the main Aikido dojo and never stopped.
Wow.
But the whole notion with the founder had a very powerful mystical experience himself, in which he realized that the core of the martial arts is to protect those you love, to protect your family or your village or your clan or your nation, protect what you care for and the people you love. And he reflected, well, how can you really, really protect those you love? It's through love, not through violence. That violence will only create more violence. So if you really care about protecting people you love and a culture and civilization you love, you need to do it with love, but in a very clear and grounded and powerful way. And so, I had no idea at the time I was going to become a Sufi. When I became a Sufi, I had no idea how close it was to Aikido. But in both cases, we're talking about acting from love.
That's wonderful. So they have the commonality of love and also coming from a more mystical tradition.
Absolutely.
And Aikido sort of working with the flow and energy rather than sort of hitting against it.
Right, and that's an important technique, but in a way even deeper, one of the things I've been exploring, after all these years, has been the founder's statement, in order to do Aikido, you have to stand on the floating bridge of heaven.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
What a great phrase.
It's taken me 48 years to really begin to understand. I wouldn't say really, to begin to understand it. Because to stand on the floating bridge of heaven, again, is to stand in a liminal place. To stand, and in many ways, Sufism is very much about being comfortable with being at the threshold between heaven and earth, between the sacred and the secular.
Well, that is just so terrific, and I'm afraid we're out of time, but what a great place to wind up there on that threshold. I want to let listeners know that, your website and contact and book information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. And Robert Frazier, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, same here, and just best of luck with your book and everything.
Thanks very much.
And listeners, thank you for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. And remember to join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed on your journey.